where it is many of these generals and admirals were asking why they had to be flown in. This was live streamed. What was the point of this?
Good morning. Well, the first thing is, I think you omitted what the generals and admirals actually said. There was probably an expletive that was inserted in their comments. But I think really the reason for this unusual event at Quantico, unusual and costly event at Quantico, is probably not that hard to figure out. It's the greatest of all photo ops. We're all used to photo ops, President Trump with police chiefs as the backdrop, GIs with the backdrop. We've seen them in prior administrations. If you remember the mission accomplished photo op that President George W. Bush offered us wrongly. So I think there's the photo op stands out as an important factor. Second, it's a way of maybe subliminally, but not so subliminally, exacting loyalty, special loyalty from the most senior officers and enlisted personnel in the U.S. Armed Forces. I think every American, by the way, should watch the video. It's extremely instructive. And even though it's time consuming and it will annoy many viewers, I think it's a critically important document that people should be exposed to.
And Mr. Feitel, I wanted to ask you, in terms of some of the stuff that Hegseth said, for instance, you kill people and break things for a living. We're training warriors, not defenders. What are they trying to impart to these generals?
I think what the broadcast here is a rejection of so many of the progressive innovations that the U.S. Armed Forces have experienced since World War II. That's what we're talking about. It wasn't until the Truman administration, for example, that there was racial desegregation in the U.S. Armed Forces. The introduction or reintroduction of women in the armed forces was a major issue. The dirty word in this environment is woke. Being woke or DEI projects, all of these serve a useful purpose in terms of integrating American society. And the U.S. Armed Forces is supposed to be a replica of American society, not simply white male American society. There were so many things that were off in this event. I'll just tick off a few if you don't mind. Personally, I found the sectarian religious references highly offensive and inappropriate. That has no place in a non-religious event, basically a command performance. I thought the notion that we're going to get tough with people, as if that's something new. The U.S. Armed Forces have always been tough. But the difference is that until now, there's been no question about our armed forces' compliance, strong efforts to comply with the rules of armed conflict. What you hear here is a replica of things that happened in President Trump's first administration, where he was pardoning people that were charged with or had been convicted of highly illegal conduct in war zones. And what this is a kind of green light that we're going to throw the rule book out. And you have to connect some dots here. Remember, one of the first things this administration did was fire a couple of the judge advocates general, the senior lawyers, senior uniform lawyers of the armed forces. That's a terrible signal. And as if they were like softies. They weren't softies. They were tough people who rose by dint of their natural gifts, their training, their loyalty, their patriotism to the highest levels. So you have to view this holistically with other things that have happened. I think that one scary point that Mr. Hegseth made was that they were going to make sure that anyone who made a complaint in the armed forces that was later shown not to be substantiated would themselves be subject to prosecution. Well, Can you think of a better way to chill the filing of complaints? Now, certainly there are valid complaints and there are invalid complaints, and there are complaints that are somewhere in between that require some investigation. But what they've done here is send a clear signal that if you make a complaint, you are going to personally be in the crosshairs if it turns out that we don't agree with your complaint. That's a preposterous position.
So what do you see as the likelihood, following from that, that the officer class would refuse to deploy troops against U.S. citizens, Eugene Fadell?
Well, my feeling is that the people who are going to be on the receiving end of these orders, I'm talking about the senior officers, they should be talking to their lawyers, and not necessarily their staff judge advocate, their uniform lawyers assigned to advise them, because they may need more independent and confidential advice as to what to do. Remember, the staff judge advocate is not the commander's lawyer. The staff judge advocate works for the government. And those conversations may prove not to be confidential. And what these senior officers need most of all is some good private legal advice to help them ensure that they can distinguish between orders that are lawful and orders that are not lawful. Orders that are lawful, of course, have to be complied with. But some of these issues, some of these orders about the internal war, for example, or going to war in Chicago as a training mission, raise questions as to whether they're lawful or not under, for example, the Posse Comitatus Act, the 19th century legislation that's been on the books and has made sure that the Army, the military, is not involved in garden variety law enforcement until now. Some of those issues are going to be touchy legal issues that lawyers are going to have to get smart on, hit the books, and be prepared to give advice. Maybe the senior officers are going to be able to get that advice that they badly need, and we already know that based on what Mr. Hegseth and the president have said. And maybe they'll be able to get it within the service, but if I were a general or an admiral right now, I'd pick up the phone and call my lawyer, preferably somebody who is knowledgeable in the field.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you as well, the U.S. military, probably of any institution in American society, has made the most strides, especially during the volunteer army period, in terms of racial diversity and ethnic diversity. 35% to 40% of the U.S. military are African American and Latino. How do you sense that this whole anti-woke theory of Hegseth and the president, what kind of impact will this have on U.S. military morale?
I think it's going to have a very bad impact. We've learned correctly over the last several generations that unit cohesion is so critical. And in our country, cohesion is not everybody looks alike, talks alike, you know, and so forth. It's a cohesion based on diversity and the celebration of diversity in our country. Remember what the great poem, the New Colossus, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. People accepted that offer. My family, everybody's family can account for that, except Native Americans. And we'll get to the Native American community in a minute. But we've just made tremendous strides, as you point out. And I see this going back in time to an all-white, all-male military establishment. And I think that that would be so unfortunate. Even when I was on active duty, even though it was well after the Truman administration, there were still holdovers, people who worked in the galley on Coast Guard cutters were often African-American, black sailors. There were stewards who were often Filipino-Americans. And that's not that long ago. So, you know, even since then, we've made tremendous strides. And if you look at some of the people who have been sidelined by this administration, some of these fantastic women officers, fantastic officers of color, you know, there's a lesson there. There's a lesson that Americans have to take away. This is an administration that wants to turn back the hands of the social clock, whether it's Teddy Roosevelt charging up San Juan Hill, or whether, I mean, what, to pick your historic illustration, but it's not today's America. It's not today's armed forces. So fasten your safety belts. This is going to be a wild ride. Now, I want to say a word. I mentioned the Native American situation. There was one point that President Trump made in his remarks at Quantico that I think has been neglected. One of the things he's celebrating in American history is the war that we waged against Native American tribes, as if that was something to celebrate. I happen to live in a town, Stockbridge, Massachusetts, that was an Indian town. It was the Stockbridge-Munsee Nation, which is now no longer in this area. But, you know, we have to be aware of the fact that our history in dealing with Native Americans is a very, very grim and bloody affair. And for him to celebrate the Indian Wars, to use the, you know, the old term, is really shocking in this day and age.
Eugene
End of editorial on that.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, senior research scholar at Yale Law School, where he teaches military justice. We'll link to your piece in The Hill. Trump and Hegseth want to turn the military into a tool of personal loyalty. Coming up, we go to a major decision. A Reagan-appointed judge in Boston has issued a scathing rebuke of the Trump administration for illegally trying to deport pro-Palestinian international students and academics back in 20 seconds. We'll be also speaking with Mahmoud Khalil.
Sad scenes of destruction on every hand. Black waters, black waters rise over. Sings a sweet tune in the roots of tall timbers. She nests with her young. When the hillside explodes and the dynamite's roar, the voice of the small bird is heard there no more. And the mountain comes sliding so.
Former Nora Brown, Stephanie Coleman in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A Reagan-appointed judge in Boston has issued a scathing rebuke of the Trump administration for illegally trying to deport pro-Palestinian international students and academics. The lawsuit was filed by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University on behalf of the AAUP, that's the American Association of University Professors, in March. In his 161-page decision, U.S. District Judge William Young wrote, quote, "This case, perhaps the most important ever to fall within the jurisdiction of this district court, squarely presents the issue of whether non-citizens lawfully present here in the United States actually have the same free speech rights as the rest of us. The court answers this constitutional question unequivocally. Yes, they do." Young went on to write, "The First Amendment does not draw President Trump's invidious distinction and is not to be found in our history or jurisprudence. No one's freedom of speech is unlimited, of course, but these limits are the same for both citizens and non-citizens alike." Judge Young also wrote, quote, "This court finds by clear and convincing evidence that the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, and the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, together with the subordinate officials and agents of each of them, deliberately and with purposeful aforethought, did so concert their actions and those of their two departments intentionally to chill the rights to freedom of speech and peacefully to assemble of the non-citizen plaintiff members, unquote. Judge Young's published ruling begins in an unusual fashion. At the top of his opinion, he included a scanned image of an anonymous threat that had been sent to his chambers in June that ominously asked, quote, Trump has pardons and tanks. What do you have? Unquote. Below the postcard, Judge Young wrote this message. Dear Mr. or Ms. Anonymous, alone I have nothing but my sense of duty. Together we, the people of the United States, you and me, have our magnificent Constitution. Here's how that works out in a specific case. Unquote. And he went on to lay out his decision. We're joined now by three guests. The lawsuit was filed after federal agents detained Columbia University student protest leader Mahmoud Khalil in March after he took part in Palestine solidarity protests at his university, Columbia. He was held for over 100 days in an ICE jail in Louisiana. During that time, his wife, Dr. Noor Abdullah, gave birth to their first child, Dean. Mahmoud was released June 20th, but the Trump administration is still trying to deport him. He's joining us from Brooklyn. In Philadelphia, we're joined by Todd Wolfson, president of the AAUP. That's the American Association of University Professors. And in studio with us in New York, Alex Abdo is with us, litigation director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. We welcome all of you back to Democracy Now! Alex, let's begin with you. I mean, the significance of this scathing decision, the judge basically said it's the most important of his career.
It's a historic decision, and it reaffirms what should have been obvious, which is that if free speech means anything in this country, it means mass government agents can't pick you up off the street and throw you into jail because of what you've said. In ordinary times, you would expect the Department of Justice to react to a ruling like this by saying, of course, we are not intentionally targeting people for their political views, but instead the administration has doubled down on the legal theory it has behind the case, which is why it's so important that you have a federal judge, a judge who's been on the bench for decades, speaking so clearly and cogently about the stakes of this case and the other efforts by this administration to crack down on dissent and political speech it doesn't like.
Alex, at the same time, though, the judge deferred a decision about what remedy to impose and said he's going to schedule a hearing promptly. What does that mean, and how do you see the case developing from here?
Well, he divided the case into two sections. The first, which is the one we just finished, focused on the question of, is the administration, in fact, targeting pro-Palestinian protesters on the basis of their speech? And if so, does that violate the First Amendment? And he answered both of those questions unequivocally. Yes, the government has, in fact, been targeting protesters on the basis of their speech, and that violates the First Amendment. And now the question is going to be what remedy he'll issue. And we're going to have presumably briefing about that question, and we'll ask Judge Young to take a series of measures designed to prevent what has been going on in the cases of these individual protesters.
So I want to talk to one of these protesters, Mahmoud Khalil. But first, tell us, what does it mean that an immigration judge has just ruled Mahmoud can be deported to Syria or Algeria, but now this decision has come down?
Well, I think this decision will provide ammunition to the legal teams in his case and in the cases of the other protesters who have been trying to convince immigration judges that the reason they were targeted was for their speech. And the administration, the federal administration, has held out the possibility that they have some kind of secret evidence demonstrating that what was going on here was more than just the targeting of speech. But Judge Young, in our case, had access to all of the underlying documentation because he let us go through a period of discovery, and he took these documents from the government and he reviewed them, and he was unimpressed, and he held, again, unequivocally, that what was going on here was the targeting of political speech.
So let's bring Mahmoud Khalil into this discussion. Mahmoud is a graduate and a green card holder, but a graduate of Columbia University, arrested and detained March 8th, International Women's Day, as he and his wife were coming into their university housing, and held for more than 100 days in Louisiana. Your response to this ruling, clearly the judge was furious, saying that your detention was unconstitutional, or the targeting of you was unconstitutional, Mahmoud?
Thank you so much, Amy. And absolutely, it's a welcome decision. And as Alex said, this would provide us with ammunition in our legal case against the administration. And basically, it affirmed what we already knew from the beginning, that this Trump administration is targeting us to chill speech across the country, chill pro-Palestine speech across the country. And they wanted to find a base for that. Like, even in, and I mean, the court documents revealed a lot of important details about the process of targeting me and other students. They had no basis. Yet they brought this foreign policy determination, and after they felt that they would lose on that, which now they did, they resorted to bringing baseless charges, fraud charges against me to have another leg to stand on. And another important thing about this particular ruling is that the judge said that speaking up for Palestine and for Palestinian liberation is protected, is not supporting terrorism as this administration is trying to do. And as you said, Rubio and Neom, with the support of the White House too, they technically conspired to deprive us from our freedom of speech, so that they can advance their ideological agenda in this country.
And but Mahmoud, earlier this month, a judge in Louisiana ruled that you are deportable. What are your lawyers saying about how this decision will affect that one? And what's the status of that Louisiana decision right now?
Yeah, the immigration courts are kangaroo courts. They answer to the attorney general, to the executive branch. They are basically affirming a decision or a court ruling, an immigration court ruling that I'm deportable based on baseless charges. So as I've said before, this case now shows to the federal court, to my federal court in New Jersey, that the administration, the Trump administration, basically conspired to deport me. They had no legal basis to do that, and they say it in one of the documents that was presented in the case. They said they had no alternative grounds to deport me. So this would be very important, because that would show that the administration actions against me in particular are in retaliation of my freedom of speech, and designed to make an example out of me, so that others would be afraid of speaking out.
I wanted to bring in Todd Wilson as well, the president of the American Association of University Professors, former colleague of mine at Rutgers University. Todd, your response to the judge's decision, and why the AAUP felt so that it needed to be a plaintiff in this case.
Yeah, I mean, we're really happy about this decision as a step forward. I mean, as Mahmoud and Alex detailed, it just confirms what we knew, that this was unconstitutional and illegal, these abductions for political speech. And the reason we took this case on is because, you know, faculty, students, and staff in higher education are living in fear right now. The Trump administration is purposefully attacking our sector, attacking our speech rights, attacking our institutions, whether it's Columbia and Harvard or UCLA. And we felt like it was critical to step up and step into this fight through the courts and through other mechanisms to push back and to defend our members, who are largely faculty, but also students and staff working on our campuses.
I wanted to go back to Mahmoud Khalil. Mahmoud, we were there at Newark Airport when you were flown back in after being released from that ICE jail in Jena, Louisiana. You reunited with your wife, with Dr. Dean Abdullah, an American citizen, a dentist, you were taken from her in March as the two of you were standing in the lobby of your building. And then you had to experience your son Dean's birth over the telephone in jail as your wife gave birth. Can you talk about what this experience has been like for you? The effect of this jailing. Now you've been out for a few months. I mean, you've been standing in Congress with Rashida Tlaib. You've spoken all over. We saw you at Columbia University surrounded by professors, by activists, by people celebrating your release. But what has it meant? And also to spend this last month with your little baby.
No, thank you, Amy. I mean, it has been absolutely great to be reunited with the family and to make up for the time that was stripped from us, from my wife, Noor, and my son, Dean. That's why, you know, like I'm cherishing these moments, but also that means that I have a duty, I have a responsibility to continue to speak up against what's happening to me and to my people. That explains why I'm involved in these steps to seek accountability, because let's be clear, nothing would ever make up for the time missed away from my family, for missing the birth of my child. Not this ruling, not any other ruling. That's why I will continue to seek accountable so this doesn't happen to anyone else, and that the administration would feel deterred from continuing to targeting people for their freedom of speech. And it's very important to continue to speak out, because this is what this administration and this is what the court now confirmed, that this administration's intention was to chill our speech. So I want to continue to speak up against this administration to show that they will never succeed in silencing us against all the atrocities that are happening against our people in Palestine.
Alex Abdo, you were with the Knight First Amendment Center, which brought the case, and the people that you talked about who were targeted. There was Mahmoud, taken on March 8th. Mm-hmm. A few weeks later, Mohsen Madawi was taken, another Palestinian student who's now a graduate student at Columbia. He went to court yesterday in downtown Manhattan, as did Rumeysa Ozturk, the Tufts University student. They were both in federal court. Can you explain how this decision affects what's happening to them right now?
Yeah, so they were both in court yesterday because the government has argued that they're not entitled to challenge their detention, even if the government threw them in jail specifically for the reason of trying to silence their speech and to chill others. And the hope is that a ruling like yesterday's will break the spell, because the goal of this administration in all of these cases in which it is cracking down on political speech is to silence dissent. They're not trying to win in court, because they can't, because the legal theories they're advancing are preposterous. And in another era, would have been shameful for DOJ lawyers to present in federal court. But we need to break the spell. We need more people like Judge Young, like Mahmoud Khalil, to call it for what it is, which is a concerted effort by the federal government to crack down on political speech. So if this decision contributes in small part to breaking the spell, then I think it will have been a success.
Alex Abdo, I want to thank you so much for being with us, litigation director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Todd Wolfson, speaking to us from Philadelphia, president of the American Association of University Professors. And Mahmoud Khalil, Columbia University graduate, an activist who spent over 100 days in an ICE jail. He was sent to Jena, Louisiana. During that time, his wife, Dr. Noor Abdullah, gave birth to their first son, Dean. He was released on June 20th. This coming weekend, I'll be speaking at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco on Saturday and in Berkeley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
My name's Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. transition all existing programs to $10 a day, and plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.